Chapter 33. It was him, Lindsay, wasn't it? Cindy was on the phone. It was after 11. I was trying to pull my wits together at the end of an insane, horrible night. I had just come in from taking Martha on a late walk. All I wanted was to take a hot shower and wash the image of Art Davidson's body out of my mind. You have to tell me. It was the same guy. Chimera, wasn't it? I threw myself onto my bed. We don't know. There was nothing at the scene. You know, Lindsay. I know you know. We both know it was him. I just wanted her to let me be and curl up in bed. I don't know, I said wearily. It could be. What caliber was the gun? Did it match Catching's? Please, Cindy, don't try to play detective on me. I knew the guy. His partner said it was his kid's 7th birthday. He had 5 children. I'm sorry, Lindsay. Cindy finally came back in a softer, gentler voice. It's just that it's like the first murder, Lindsay. The shot that no one else could make. We sat a while on the phone without talking. She was right. I knew she was right. Then Cindy said, You've got another one, don't you, Lindsay? I didn't answer, but I knew what she meant. Another pattern killer. A cold-blooded marksman. And he's targeting blacks. Not just blacks, I sighed. Not just blacks? Cindy hesitated. Then she came back in a rush. The Oakland crime reporter got a rumor out of homicide there about the Chipman widow. Her husband was a cop. First Tasha's uncle, then her. Now Davidson makes three. Oh, Jesus, Lindsay. This stays with us, I insisted. Please, Cindy, I need to sleep now. You don't realize how hard this is for us. Let us help, Lindsay. All of us, we want to help you. I will, Cindy. I need your help. I need all of your help. Chapter 34. I thought of something during the night. The killer had called 911. I got right on it in the morning. Lila McHenry ran dispatch. She had been on the board when the Davidson call came in. Lila was plump, rosy-cheeked, and quick to smile. But no one was more professional, and she could coolly juggle serious situations like an air traffic controller. She set up the tape of the actual 911 call in the squad room. The entire detail huddled around. Cappy and Jacoby had come in before heading back out to Vallejo. It's on a 3-loop reel, Lila explained. She pressed the playback key. In a few seconds, we were going to hear the killer's voice for the first time. San Francisco Police, 911 hotline, a dispatcher's voice said. There wasn't another sound in the squad room. An agitated male voice shot back.
I need to call in a disturbance. Some guy's doing an OJ on his wife.
Okay, the operator replied. I'll need to start with your location. Where is this disturbance taking place? There was an interfering background noise like a TV or traffic making it difficult to hear.
303 7th, 4th floor. You better send someone out. It's starting to sound real bad.
You said the address was 303 7th?
That's right.
And who am I speaking with? The operator asked.
My name's Billy. Billy Reffin. I live down the hall. You better hurry.
We all looked around, surprised. The killer gave a name? Jesus. Listen, sir, the dispatcher asked. Are you able to hear what's going on as I am talking to you?
What I can hear is some spook getting the living shit beat out of her.
The dispatcher hesitated. Yes, sir. Can you determine if there's been a physical injury so far?
I'm no doctor, lady. I'm just trying to do the right thing. Just send someone.
Okay, Mr. Farron, I'm calling a patrol car now. What I want you to do is exit the building and wait for the officers. They're on the way.
You better move quick. Sounds like someone's about to get hurt.
After the transmission ended, there was the follow-up recording of the outgoing dispatch call. The call came from a mobile phone, Lila said. shrugging her broad shoulders. No doubt cloned. Here, it's starting up again on a 3-cycle loop. In a moment, the tape came on a second time. This time, I listened closely for what the voice could tell me.
I need to call in a disturbance.
It was a worried voice, panicked but cool. This guy's a good fucking actor, Jacoby huffed.
My name's Billy. Billy Reffin.
I clenched the edges of my wooden chair as I listened to the dispatcher's well-intended instructions. Exit the building and wait for the officers. They're on the way. All the while, he was sitting behind a rifle scope, waiting for his prey to show up.
You better move quick. Someone's about to get hurt.
This time, I heard the mocking indifference in his voice. Not even the slightest tone of compassion for what he was about to do. In the last warning, I even detected a hint of a cold chuckle.
Quick, someone's about to get hurt.
That's all I have, Lila McKendry said. The killer's voice. Chapter 35. The Davidson murder changed everything. A bold headline in the Chronicle shouted, "Murdered cop thought to be third in terror spree." The front page article, with Cindy's byline, cited the accurate long-range rifle shots and also the symbol used by active hate groups that had been found at the scenes. I headed down to the CSU lab and found Charlie Clapper curled up behind a metal desk wearing a lab coat, munching on a breakfast of Doritos chips. His salt-and-pepper hair was oily and tousled, and his eyes sagged like heavy bags. "I've slept at this desk twice this week," he scowled. "Doesn't anyone get killed during the day anymore?" "In case you didn't notice, I haven't been getting my normal beauty rest the last week either," I shrugged. "Come on, Charlie. I need something on this Davidson thing. He's killing our own guys." "I know he is," the rotund CSU man sighed. He hoisted himself up and shuffled over to a counter. He picked up a small Ziploc sandwich bag with a dark, flattened bullet in it. "Here's your slug, Lindsay. Took it out of the wall behind where Art Davidson got dropped. One shot, lights out. Check with Claire if you like. The son of a bitch can definitely shoot." I lifted up the shell and tried to pull a reading. 40 caliber, Clapper said. "My first read is that it's from a PSG-1. I frowned. "You're sure about this, Charlie?" Tasha Catchings had been killed with an M16. He pointed toward a scope. "Be my guest, Lieutenant. I figure ballistics must be a lifelong study of yours." "I didn't mean that, Charlie. I was just hoping for a match on the Catchings girl." "Reese is still working on it," he said, grabbing a chip out of the Doritos bag. "But don't bet on it. This guy was clean, Lindsay. Just like at the church. No prints, nothing left behind. The tape machine standard could have been bought anywhere. Set off by a long-distance remote control. We even traced what we thought would be his route up there through the building and dusted everything from the railings to the window locks. We did turn up one thing." "What's that?" I pressed. He walked me over to a lab counter. "Partial sneaker print. Off the tar on the roof where the shots came from. Looks like a standard shoe. But we did take out some traces of a fine white powder. No guarantees it even came from him." "Powder?" "Chalk," Charlie said. "That narrows it down to about 50 million possibilities. If this guy's signing his pictures, Lindsay, he's making it tough to find."
"He signed it, Charlie," I said with conviction. "It was the shot."
"We're sending the 911 tape out for a voice reading. I'll let you know when we get it back." I patted him appreciatively. "Get some sleep, Charlie." He lifted the Doritos bag. "Sure I will. After breakfast."
Chapter 36. I went back to the office and sank disappointedly back behind my desk. I had to know more about that chimera. I was about to dial Stu Kirkwood at the hate crimes desk when a cadre of three men in dark suits came into the squad room. One of them was Mercer, no surprise. He had been on the morning talk shows, pushing for calm. I knew facing tough questions without concrete results didn't sit well with him. But the other, accompanied by his press liaison, was a man I had never seen on the floor in 6 years in homicide. It was the mayor of San Francisco. "I don't want the slightest bit of bullshit," Art Fernandez, San Francisco's two-term mayor, said. "I don't want the standard protecting the ranks, and I don't want any misplaced reflex to control the situation." He shifted his eyes on a narrow track between Mercer and me. "What I want is an honest answer. Do we have a read on this situation?" We were crammed into my tiny glass-enclosed office. Outside, I could see staffers standing around, watching the circus. I fumbled under my desk to get my pumps back on. "We do not," I admitted. "So Vernon Jones is right." The mayor exhaled, sinking into a chair across from my desk. "What we have is an out-of-control spree of hate-driven killings on which the police have no handle, but the FBI may." "No, that's not it," I replied. "That's not it?" He arched his eyebrows. He looked at Mercer and frowned. "What is it I don't understand? You've got a recognized hate group symbol, this chimera, at two of the three crime scenes. Our own M.E. believes the Catchings girl was the intended target of this madman." "What the lieutenant is saying," Mercer cut in, "is that this may not be simply a hate crime issue." My mouth was a little cottony, and I swallowed. "I think it's deeper than a hate crime spree." "Deeper, Lieutenant Boxer? Just what is it you believe we have?" I stared straight at Fernandez. "What I think we have is someone with a personal vendetta, possibly a single assailant. He's couching his murder in the M.O. of a hate crime." "A vendetta, you say?" Carr, the mayor's man, chimed in. "A vendetta against blacks, but not a hate crime. Against black children and widows, but not a hate crime." "Against black cops," I said. The mayor's eyes narrowed. "Go on." I explained that Tasha Catchings and Estelle Chipman had been related to cops. "There has to be some further relationship, though we don't know what it is yet. The killer is organized, haughty in the way he's leaving his clues. I do not believe a hate crime killer would leave their mark on the hits. The getaway van, the little drawing in Chipman's basement, that cocky 911 tape. I don't think this is a hate crime spree. It's a vendetta. Calculated. Personal." The mayor looked at Mercer. "You go along with this, Earl?" "Protecting the ranks aside," Mercer smiled tightly, "I do." "Well, I don't," Carr said. "Everything points to a hate crime." There was silence in the cramped room. The temperature suddenly felt like 120 degrees. "So it seems I have two choices," the mayor said. "Under the hate crimes legislation, Article 4, I can call in the FBI, who, I believe, keep a close watch on these groups. They have no fucking idea how to run a homicide investigation," Mercer protested. "Or I can let the lieutenant do her job, tell the feds we got it all handled ourselves," the mayor said. I met his eyes. "I went to the academy with Art Davidson. You think you want to catch his killer any more than I do?" "Then catch him," the mayor said and rose. "Just so we know what's at stake," he added. I was nodding glumly when Lorraine burst through my door. "Sorry to interrupt, Lieutenant, but it's urgent. Jacoby called in from Vallejo. He said, make the place up nice and neat for an important guest. They found the biker from the Blue Parrot." They found Red. Chapter 37. About an hour later, Jacoby and Cappy entered the squad room. They were pushing a large, red-headed biker type, his hands cuffed behind his back. Look who decided to drop in, Jacoby smirked.
Red jerked his arms defiantly out of Cappy's grip as the policeman shoved him into Interrogation Room 1, where he tripped over a wooden chair and crashed to the floor.
I'm sorry, big fella, Cappy shrugged. Thought I warned you about that first step.
Richard Earl Evans, Jacoby announced, a.k.a. Red Boomer Duke. Don't feel insulted if he doesn't stand up and shake hands.
This is what you thought I meant by no contact? I said, looking cross, but inside, delighted that they had brought him in.
The guy's got a CCI sheet so long it begins with Call Me Ishmael, Jacoby grinned. Theft, aggravated mischief, attempted murder, 2 weapons charges.
Behold, exclaimed Cappy, producing a dime bag of marijuana, a 5-inch hunter's blade, and a palm-sized Beretta 22 caliber pistol out of a Nordstrom's shopping bag. You know why he's here? I asked.
Nah, Cappy grunted. We busted him on the gun charge. Let him cool his jets in the back seat.
The three of us crowded into the small interrogation room facing Richard Earl Evans. The creep leered up at us with a smug grin, sleeves of tattoos covering both arms. He wore a black T-shirt with block letters on the back. If you can read this, the bitch must have fallen off. I nodded, and Cappy freed him from his cuffs.
You know why you're here, Mr. Evans?
I know you guys are in deep shit if you think I'm talking to you. Evans sniffed a mixture of mucus and blood. You got no teeth in Vallejo.
I raised the bag of dope.
Santa seems to have brought you a lot of naughty toys. 2 felonies, still on parole for a weapons charge, time at Folsom, Quentin. My sense is you must like it there, 'cause next time up, you qualify for the 30-year lease.
One thing I do know, Evans rolled his eyes, is you didn't drag me all this way for some 2-bit weapons rap.
The sign on the door says homicide.
No, big fella, you're right, Cappy injected. Tossing your sorry ass into jail on a gun charge is only a hobby for us. But depending on how you answer a few questions, that weapons rap could determine where you spend the next 30 years.
Pup shit, the biker grunted, leveling his cold, hard eyes in his face. That's all you assholes got on me.
Cappy shrugged, then brought the flat end of an unopened soda can down hard on the biker's hand. Evans yelped in pain.
Damn, I thought you said you were thirsty, Cappy said contritely.
Red leered at Cappy, no doubt imagining running over the cop's face with his bike.
But you're right, Mr. Evans, I said. We didn't ask you down here to go over your current possessions, though it wouldn't take much to hand your sorry ass right over to the Vallejo police. But today could work out lucky for you.
Cappy, ask Mr. Evans if he'd like another drink.
Cappy fainted, and Evans jerked his hand off the table. Then the big cop opened the can and placed it in front of him, grinning widely.
This all right?
Or would you prefer a glass?
See, I assured him.
We can be nice.
Truth is, we don't give a shit about you. All you have to do is answer a few questions and you'll be headed home. Compliments of the SFPD. You never have to see us again. Or we can lock your 3-time loser ass on the 10th floor for a few days until we remember that we got you here and notify the Vallejo police. And when it comes to a 3rd felony offense, we'll see about just how much teeth we really have.
Evans ran his hand across the bridge of his nose, dabbing at the blood.
Maybe I will take a swig of that soda if you're still offering.
Congratulations, son, Jacoby said. That's the first thing you've done makes sense since we set eyes on you.
Chapter 38. I laid out a black and white surveillance photo of the Templars in front of Red's startled face. First thing we need to know is where can we find your buddies?
Evans looked up, grinning.
So that's what this is all about?
Come on, sharp as nails, pressed Jacoby. The lieutenant asked a question. One by one, I spread on the table 3 more photos showing various members. Evans shook his head. Never ran with those guys. The last photo I put down was a surveillance shot of him. Cappy reached out, all 250 pounds of him, and raised the biker by the shirt, lifting him out of his seat. Listen, codshit, you're only lucky we're not concerned here with what you sorry bunch of losers got off doing. So act smart and you'll be out of here, and we can go on to what we do give a shit about. Evans shrugged. Maybe I did run a bit with them, but no more. Club's disbanded. Too much heat. I ain't seen these guys around here in months. They split. You want to find them? Start with 5 South. I looked at the 2 inspectors. As much as I doubted whether Evans would actually turn over on his buddies, I believed him. One more question, I said. A big one. I laid down the photo of the biker with the chimera jacket. What does this mean to you? Evans sniffed. Dude's got bogus taste in attire. Cappy leaned forward. Evans recoiled. It's a symbol, man. Means he's in the movement. A patriot. A patriot? I asked him. What the hell is that supposed to mean? An advocate of the white race, the self-determination of a free and orderly society. He smiled at Cappy. Present company excluded, of course. Of course, none of this shit necessarily reflects my personal views. Did this guy head off to the Sun Belt, too? Jacoby asked. Him? Why, what do you think he's done? There he goes, Cappy stood over him, answering questions with questions again. Look, Evans swallowed. The brother only hung with us a short while. I don't even know his real name, MacMillan, MacArthur, what'd he do? I figured there was no reason not to tell him what we thought. What's the word about what happened in LaSalle Heights? Red finally flinched. His pupils widened. All of a sudden, it was falling into place. You think my old dudes lit up that church? This guy? Mac? You know how we could talk to him? I said. Evans grinned. That's a tough order, even for you. Try us, I said. We're resourceful. I'm sure you are. But this fucker's dead. Back in June, he and a partner blew themselves up in Oregon. Son of a bitch must have read somewhere you could turn cow shit into a bomb. Chapter 39. In the small blacktop parking lot adjacent to the LaSalle Heights Church, Cindy Thomas jumped out of her Mazda. Her stomach growled, telling her that it didn't quite know what she was doing here. She took a breath and opened the large oak door into the main chapel. Just yesterday, it had been filled with the choir's resonating sound. Now it was eerily quiet, the pews empty. She walked through the chapel and into a connecting building. A carpeted hallway led to a row of offices. A black woman, glancing up from a copy machine, asked, "Can I help you? What do you want?" "I'm here to see Reverend Winslow." "Oh, he's not seeing visitors now," the woman said. Winslow's voice rang out from one of the offices. "It's all right, Carol." Cindy was led to his office. It was small, crowded with books. He was wearing a black T-shirt and khakis and didn't look like any minister she'd ever known. "So, we managed to get you back after all," he said. Then finally, he smiled. He had her take a seat on a small couch, and he sat in a well-worn red leather chair. A pair of glasses was resting on a book nearby, and she instinctively sneaked a peek. A heartbreaking work of staggering genius. Not what she would have expected. "You mending?" she asked. "Trying to. I read your story today. It's terrible about that policeman. It's true? Tasha's murder might be tied up with 2 others?" "The police think so," Cindy answered. "The ME believes she was deliberately shot." Winslow grimaced, and then he shook his head. "I don't understand. Tasha was just a little girl. What possible connection could there be?" "It wasn't so much Tasha,"
Cindy held eye contact with Aaron Winslow, as what she represented. All the victims apparently have a link to San Francisco cops. Winslow's eyes narrowed. So tell me, what brings you back so soon? Your soul aching? Why are you here? Cindy lowered her eyes. The service yesterday, it was moving. I felt chills. It's been a long time for me. Actually, I think my soul has been aching. I just haven't bothered to notice. Winslow's look softened. She'd told him a small truth, and it had touched him. Well, good. I'm glad to hear you are moved. Cindy smiled. Incredibly, he made her feel at ease. He seemed centered, genuine, and she'd heard nothing but good things about him. She wanted to do a story on him, and she knew it would be a good one, maybe a great story. I bet I know what you're thinking, Aaron Winslow said. Okay, she said. Shoot. You're wondering. The man seems together enough, not completely weirded out. He doesn't seem like a minister. So what is he doing making his living working like this? Cindy flashed an embarrassed smile. I admit, something like that did cross my mind. I'd like to do a story about you in the Bayview neighborhood. He seemed to be thinking it over, but then he changed the subject on her. What is it you like to do, Cindy? Do? But in the big, bad world of San Francisco you cover out there, after you call in your story. What moves you besides your job at the Chronicle? What are your passions? She found herself smiling. Hey, I ask the questions. I want to do a story on you, not the other way around, she said. All right. I like yoga. I take a class twice a week on Chestnut Street. Do you ever do yoga? No, but I meditate every day. Cindy smiled some more. She wasn't even sure why. I'm in a woman's book club. Two women's clubs, actually. I like jazz. Winslow's eyes lit. What kind of jazz? I like jazz myself. Cindy laughed. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. What kind of jazz do you like? Progressive, interpretive, anything from Pine Top Perkins to Coltrane. You know the Blue Door on Geary? She asked. Of course I know the Blue Door. I go there Saturday nights, whenever Carlos Reyes is in town. Maybe we could go sometime, as a part of your story. You don't have to answer right now. Then you agree to let me do a piece on you, Cindy said. I agree. To let you do a piece on the neighborhood, I'll help you with it. A half hour later, in her car, Cindy sat letting the engine run, almost too astonished to put it in gear. I don't believe what I just did. Lindsay would rap her in the head, question whether her gadgets were properly working. But they were working. They were humming a little, actually. The tiny hairs on her arms were standing straight up. She had the beginnings of what she thought might be a good story, maybe a prize winner. She'd also just accepted a date from Tasha Catching's pastor, and she couldn't wait to see him again. Maybe my soul has been aching, Cindy thought as she finally drove away from the church. Chapter 40. It was close to 7 on Saturday, the end of a long, insane, incredibly stressful week. 3 people had died. My only good leads had come and gone. I needed to talk to somebody, so I went up to 8, where the DA's staff was located. 2 doors down from the big man himself was Jill's corner office. The executive corner was dark, offices empty, staff scattered for the weekend. In a way, though I needed to vent, I was sort of hoping Jill, the new Jill, would be at home, maybe picking through swatch books for her baby's room. But as I approached, I heard the sound of classical music coming from within. Jill's door was cracked half open. I knocked gently and pushed it in. There was Jill, in her favorite easy chair, knees tucked to her chest, and a yellow legal pad resting on them.
Her desk was piled high with briefs. "Why are you here?" I asked. "Snagged," she sighed, raising her hands in mock surrender. "It's just this goddamn Perrone thing. Closing arguments Monday morning. Jill was at the end of a high-profile case in which a derelict landlord was being charged with manslaughter after a faulty ceiling caved in on an 8-year-old child. You're pregnant, Jill. It's after 7 o'clock. So is Connie Sperling for the defense. They're calling it the Battle of the Bulge. Whatever they're calling it. So much for the shift of gears." Jill turned down the CD player and extended her long legs. "Anyway, Steve's out of town. What else is new? I'd only be doing the same thing if I were home." She cocked her head and smiled. "You're checking up on me." "No, but maybe someone should." "Good Lord, Lindsay. I'm just preparing notes, not running a 10K. I'm doing fine, anyway." She glanced at her watch. "Since when did you turn into the poster girl for keeping everything in perspective?" "I'm not pregnant, Jill." All right, I'll stop lecturing." I stepped inside her office, eyed her woman's Final Four soccer photo from Stanford, framed diplomas, and pictures of her and Steve rock climbing and running with their black lab snake eyes. "I still have a beer in the fridge if you want to sit," she said, tossing her legal pad on the desk. "Pull a buckler out for me." I did just that. Then I shifted the black Max Mara suit jacket, hastily thrown over a cushion, and sank back in the leather couch. We tilted our bottles, and both of us blurted in the same breath, "So, how's your case?" "You first," Jill laughed. I spread my thumb and index finger barely a half an inch apart to indicate, basically, zip. I took her through the maze of dead ends, the van, the Chimera sketch, the surveillance photo of the Templars, that CSU had come up with nothing on the Davidson ambush. Jill came over and sat beside me on the couch. "You want to talk, Linz? Like you said, you didn't come up here to make sure I was behaving myself." I smiled guiltily, then placed my beer on the coffee table. "I need to shift the investigation, Jill." "Okay," she said. "I'm listening. This is just between us." Piece by piece, I laid out my theory that the killer was not some reckless, hate-mongering maniac, but a bold, plotting, pattern killer acting out a vendetta. "Maybe you're overreaching," Jill replied. "What you do have is 3 terror crimes aimed at African Americans. So why these victims, Jill? An 11-year-old girl? A decorated cop? Estelle Chipman, whose husband has been dead for 5 years? I don't know, honey. I just nail them to the wall when you turn them over." I smiled. Then I leaned forward. "Jill, I need you to help me. I need to find some connection between these victims. I know it's there. I need to check out past cases in which a white plaintiff was victimized by a black police officer. That's where my gut leads me. It's where I think these killings might start. It has something to do with revenge. What happens when the next victim never had anything to do with a police officer? What are you going to do then?" I looked at her imploringly. "Are you going to help me?" "Of course I'm going to help you," she shook her head at me. "Duh. Anything you can give me that will help narrow it down?" I nodded. "Male? White? Maybe a tattoo or 3? "That ought to do it," she rolled her eyes. I reached out and squeezed her hand. I knew I could count on her. I looked at my watch. 7:30. "I better let you finish up while you're still in your first trimester." "Don't go, Lindsay." Jill held my arm. "Stick around." I could see something on her face. That clear, professional intensity suddenly weakened into a 1,000-yard stare. "Something wrong, Jill? Did the doctor tell you something?" In her sleeveless vest, with her dark hair curled around her ears, she looked every bit the power lawyer, number 2 in the city's legal department. But there was a tremor in her breath. "I'm fine. Really, physically, I'm fine. I should be happy, right? I'm gonna have a baby. I should be riding the air." You should be feeling whatever you're feeling, Jill. I took her hand. She nodded glassily. Then she curled her knees up to her chest. When I was a kid, I would sometimes wake up in the night. I always had this little terror, this feeling that the whole world was asleep, that around this whole huge planet, I was the only one left awake in the world. Sometimes my father would come in and try to rock me to sleep. He'd be downstairs in his study preparing his cases, and he'd always check on me before he turned in. He called me his second chair. But even with him there, I still felt so alone. She shook her head at me, tears glistening in her eyes. Look at me. Steve's away for 2 nights, and I'm turning into a fucking idiot, she said. I don't think you're an idiot, I said, stroking her pretty face. I can't lose this baby, Lindsay. I know it seems stupid. I'm carrying a life. It's here, always in me, right next to me. How is it I feel so alone? I held her tightly by the shoulders. My father had never been there to rock me to sleep. Even before he left us, he worked the third shift and would always head to McGoey's for a beer afterward. Sometimes I felt like the heartbeat that was closest to me was the pulse of the bastards I had to track down. I know what you mean, I heard myself whisper. I held Jill. Sometimes I feel that way too. Chapter 41.
On the corner of Ocean and Victoria, a man in a green fatigue windbreaker hunched, chewing a burrito as the black Lincoln slowly made its way down the block. He had waited here dozens of nights, stalked his next prey for weeks. The person he had watched for so long lived in a pleasant stucco house inside Ingleside Heights, just a short walk away. He had a family, 2 girls in Catholic school. His wife was a registered nurse. He had a black lab. Sometimes it bounded out to greet him as his car pulled up. The lab was named Bullet, like the old movie. Usually the car drove by around 7:30, a couple of times a week. The man got out to walk. It was always at the same spot on Victoria. He liked to stop at the Korean market, chat with the owner as he picked out a melon or cabbage, playing the big man walking among his people. Then he might mosey into Tiny's News, stuff his arms with a few magazines, Car and Driver, PC World, Sports Illustrated. Once, he had even stood behind him in the line as he waited to pay for his reading material. He could have taken him out many times, one dazzling shot from a distance. But no, this one had to be up close, eye to eye. This murder would blow the lid off everything, the entire city of San Francisco. This would take the case international. And not many got that big. His heart sprung alive as he huddled in the damp drizzle. But this time, the black Lincoln merely passed by. So it won't be tonight, he exhaled. Go home, dear little wife and dog, but soon. You've grown forgetful, he thought, bawling his burrito into the wrapper and tossing it in the trash bin. Forgetful of the past, but it always finds you. I live with the past every day. He watched as the black Lincoln, its windows dark, made its customary left onto Cerritos and disappeared into Ingleside Heights. You stole my life. Now I'm going to take yours.
Chapter 42. I took Sunday morning off to run Martha by the bay and do my Tai Chi on the Marina Green. By noon, I was in jeans and a sweatshirt back at my desk. By Monday, the investigation was listing toward the dead zone. No new angles to work. We were putting out releases just to keep the press off our tail. Each stalled line of questioning, each frustrating dead end, only narrowed the time to when Chimera would strike again. I was returning some case files to Jill when the elevator door opened and Chief Mercer ambled in. He looked surprised when he saw me, but not displeased. "Come, take a ride with me," he said. Mercer's car was waiting alongside the side entrance on 8th Street. As the police driver leaned back, Mercer told him, "West Portal, Sam." West Portal was a diverse middle-class neighborhood out of the center of the city. I didn't know why Mercer would be dragging me out there in the middle of the day. As we rode, Mercer asked a few questions, but stayed mostly silent. A tremor shot through me.
He's going to take me off the case. The driver pulled onto a residential street I had never been on before. He parked in front of a small blue Victorian, across from a high school playground. A pickup basketball game was going on. I blinked first. "What is it you wanted to talk about, Chief?" Mercer turned to me. "You have any personal heroes, Lindsay?" "You mean like Amelia Earhart or Margaret Thatcher?" I shook my head. I had never grown up with those. "Maybe Claire Washburn," I grinned. Mercer nodded. "Arthur Ashe was always one of mine. Someone asked him if it was hard to cope with AIDS, and he answered, not nearly as hard as it was to deal with growing up black in the United States." His expression deepened. "Vernon Jones tells the mayor that I've lost sight of what's really at stake in this case." He pointed toward the blue Victorian across the street. "You see that house? My parents' house. I was raised there. My father was a mechanic in the transit yards, and my mother did the books for an electrical contractor. They worked their whole lives to send me and my sister to school. She's a trial litigator now in Atlanta. But this is where we're from." "My father worked for the city, too," I nodded. "I know I never told you, Lindsay, but I knew your father."
"You knew him?"
"Yeah, we started out together. Radio cops at a central. Even shifted together a few times. Marty Boxer. Your father was a bit of a legend, Lindsay, and not necessarily for exemplary duty." "Tell me something I don't know," I said. "All right," he paused. "He was a good cop then. A damned good cop. A lot of us looked up to him. Before he bagged out," I said. Mercer looked at me. "You must know by now. Things happen in a cop's life that don't always break down so easily into choices the rest of us can understand." I shook my head. "I haven't spoken to him in 22 years. Mercer nodded. "I can't speak for him as a father or as a husband. But is there a chance that as a man, or at least as a cop, you've judged him without knowing all the facts?" "He never stuck around long enough to present the facts," I said. "I'm sorry," Mercer said. "I'll tell you some things about Marty Boxer, but another time."
"Tell me what? When?"
He drew down the privacy barrier and instructed his driver that it was time to head back to the hall. "When you find Chimera." Chapter 43.
Later that night, as his town car slowed in the evening traffic near his home, Chief Mercer spoke up from the back seat.
"Why don't I get out here, Sam?"
His driver, Sam Mendez, glanced back. The mandate from the hall was no unnecessary risks. Mercer was firm on this matter. "Sam, there's more cops on patrol in a 5-block radius here than there are back at the hall. There was usually a patrol car or two cruising on Ocean and one station across from his home." The car eased to a stop. Mercer opened the door and thrust his heavy shape onto the street.
"Pick me up tomorrow, Sam. Have a good night."
As his car pulled away, Mercer lugged his thick briefcase in one hand and threw his tan raincoat over his shoulder with the other. He experienced a surge of freedom and relief. These little after-work excursions were the only times he felt free. He stopped at Kim's Market and picked out the sweetest-looking basket of strawberries and some choice plums, too. Then he wandered across the street to the Ingleside wine shop. He decided on a Beaujolais that would go with the lamb stew Eunice was making. On the street, he glanced at his watch and headed towards home. On Cerritos, two stone pillars separated Ocean from the secure enclave of Ingleside Heights. The traffic disappeared behind him. He passed the low stone house belonging to the tailors. A noise rustled out from the hedge.
"Well, well, Chief."
Mercer stopped. His heart was already pounding. "Don't be shy. I haven't seen you in years," the voice said again. "You probably don't remember." What the hell was going on? A tall, muscular man stepped out from behind the hedge. He was wearing a cocky smirk, a green windbreaker wrapped around him. A vague recognition came over Mercer, a familiarity in the face he couldn't quite place. Then all at once it came back to him. Suddenly everything made sense, and it took his breath away. "This is such an honor," the man said. "For you." He had a gun, heavy and silver. It was extended towards Mercer's chest. Mercer knew he had to do something. Ram him. Get to his gun somehow. He needed to act like a cop on the street again.
I wanted you to see my face. I wanted you to know why you were dying.
Don't do this. There are cops everywhere around here.
Good. That makes it even better for me.
Don't be scared, Chief. Where you're going, you'll be running into a lot of your old friends.
The first shot struck him in the chest, a burning, clothes-searing thud that buckled his knees. Mercer's first thought was to shout. Was it Parks or Vasquez stationed in front of his house? Only precious yards away. But his voice died inaudibly in his chest. Jesus God, please save me.
The second shot tore through his throat. He didn't know if he was up or down. He wanted to charge the killer. He wanted to take the bastard down, but his legs felt paralyzed, inert. The man with the gun was standing over him now. The bastard was still talking to him, but he couldn't hear a word. His face kept melting in and out of focus. A name flashed into his mind. It seemed impossible. He said it twice, just to be sure, his breath pounding in his ears.
That's right,
the killer said, leveling the silvery gun. You've solved the case. You figured out Chimera. Congratulations. Mercer thought he should close his eyes when the next bright orange flash exploded in his face.
Chapter 44. I will always remember what I was doing when I heard the news. I was home tending a pot of farfalle on the stove. Adia by Sarah McLachlan was playing on the stereo. Claire was coming over. I'd lured her for dinner with my famous pasta with asparagus and lemon sauce. Not lured her, actually. Begged. I wanted to talk about something other than the case. Her kids, yoga, the California Senate race, why the Warriors sucked, anything. I will never forget. Martha sat toying with a headless San Francisco Giants mascot bear that she had appropriated to her side of the property list. I was chopping basil. I checked on the pasta. Tasha Catchings and Art Davidson had drifted out of my mind. Thank God. The phone rang. A selfish thought knifed through me, hoping that it wasn't Claire bagging out of our date at the last minute. I cradled the phone in the nape of my neck and answered, "Yo." It was Sam Ryan, the department's chief of detectives. Ryan was my administrative superior in the chain of command. At the sound of his voice, I knew something had to be seriously wrong. Lindsay, something terrible has happened. My body went numb. It was like someone had reached inside my chest and squeezed my heart in their indifferent fist. I listened to Ryan speak. Three shots from point-blank range. Only a few yards from his house. Oh, my God. Mercer. Where is he, Sam? Moffitt. Emergency surgery. He's fighting. I'll be right down. I'm on my way. Lindsay, there's nothing you can do here. Get out to the scene. Chin and Lorraine will cover it. I'll be right down. The doorbell buzzed. As if in a trance, I rushed over, opened it. Hey, said Claire. I didn't say a word. In an instant, she recognized the pallor on my face. What happened? My eyes were wet. Claire, he's shot Chief Mercer. Chapter 45. We raced down the steps, climbed into Claire's Pathfinder, and made the dash from Potrero to the California Medical Center, all the way over in Parnassus Heights. The entire ride, my heart pumped madly and hopefully. The streets blurred by, 24th, Guerrero, then across the Castro on 17th, to the hospital atop Mount Sutro. Barely 10 minutes after I got the call, Claire spun the Pathfinder into a restricted parking space across from the hospital entrance. Claire ID'd herself to a nurse at the front desk, asking for an up-to-date report. She looked worried as she charged inside the swinging doors. I ran up to Sam Ryan. What's the word? He shook his head. He's on the table now. If anyone can take three bullets and make it through, it's him. I flipped open my cell phone and patched into Lorraine Stafford at the scene.
Things are crazy here, she said. There's people from internal affairs and some goddamn city crisis agency and the fucking press. I haven't been able to get close to the radio cop who was first on the scene. Don't let anyone other than you or Chin get close to that scene, I told her. I'll be out there as soon as I can. Claire came back out of the ER. Her face was drawn. They've got him open now, Lindsay. It doesn't look good. His cerebral cortex was penetrated. He's lost a ton of blood. It's a miracle he's hung on as long as he has. Claire, I've got to get in there to see him. She shook her head. He's barely alive, Lindsay. Besides, he's under anesthesia. I had this mounting sense that I owed it to Mercer, each unresolved death. That he knew, and if he died, the truth would die with him. I'm going in there. I pushed through the doors leading to the ER, but Claire held on to me. As I looked into her eyes, the last glimmer of hopefulness drained out of my body. I had always fought with Mercer, battled him. He was someone to whom I felt I always had something to prove, and prove again and again. But in the end, he had believed in me. In the strangest of ways, I felt as if I were losing a father all over again. Barely a minute later, a doctor in a green smock came out, peeling off latex gloves. He said a few words to one of the mayor's men, then to the assistant chief, Anthony Trocchio. The chief's dead, Trocchio uttered. Everyone stood staring blankly ahead. Claire put an arm around me and hugged. I don't know if I can do this, I said, holding tightly onto her shoulder. Yes, you can, she said. I caught Mercer's doctor as he was headed back to the ER. I introduced myself. Did he say anything when he was brought in? The doctor shrugged. He held on for a while, but whatever he said was incoherent, just reflexive. He was on life support from the moment he came in. His brain was still working, wasn't it, doctor? He had faced his killer head on, taken 3 shots. I could see Mercer holding on just long enough to say something. Anything you remember. His tired eyes searched for something. I'm sorry, Inspector. We were trying to save his life. You might try the EMS techs who brought him in. He went back inside. Through the windows in the ER doors, I caught a glimpse of Eunice Mercer and one of their teenage daughters, tearfully hugging in the corridor. My insides felt as if they were ripping apart, a knot of nausea building. I ran into the ladies' room. I bent over the sink and splashed cold water all over my face. God damn it! God damn it! When my body calmed, I looked up in the mirror. My eyes were dark, hollow, and blank. Voices drummed loudly in my head. 4 murders, they told. 4 black cops. Chapter 46. Lorraine Stafford walked me down from the stone gate on Cerritos. The chief was on his way home. She bit her bottom lip. He lived a couple of houses down that way. No witnesses, but his driver's over there. I went to the spot where Mercer's body had been found. Charlie Clapper's team was already combing all around it. It was a quiet, residential street, the sidewalk guarded by a high hedge that would have blocked anyone from seeing the killer. The spot had already been chalked off. Blotches of blood soaked the pavement inside the outline of the body. The remains of his last moments, some plastic bags containing magazines, fruit, and a bottle of wine, were scattered around. "Didn't he have a car stationed in front of his house?" I asked. Lorraine nodded toward a young uniformed officer leaning against the hood of a blue and white. By the time he got down here, the perp had fled and the chief was bleeding out. It became clear the killer had been lying in wait. He must have hidden in the bushes until Mercer came by. He must have known, just like he knew with Davidson. From up on ocean, I saw Jacoby and Cappy coming toward us. The sight of them made me exhale with relief. "Thanks for coming down," I whispered. Then Jacoby did something totally uncharacteristic.
He grasped my shoulder and looked firmly into my eyes. This is going to get big, Lindsay. Feds are going to come in. Anything we can do, anything you need, any time you need to talk about it, you know I'm here for you. I turned to Lorraine and Chin. What do you need to finish up here? I want to check along the escape route, Chin said. If he had a car parked, someone must have seen it. Otherwise, maybe someone saw him come out on ocean. Fucking chief. Jacoby sighed. I always thought the guy would hold a news conference at his own funeral. We still classifying this as a hate crime, Lieutenant? Cappy sniffed. I don't know about you, I said, but I hate this bastard pretty bad. Chapter 47. Jacoby was right about one thing. The next morning, everything had changed. A feeding frenzy of every news organization in the country was massing on the outside steps of the Hall of Justice, setting up their camera crews, clawing for interviews. Anthony Trocchio was named acting chief. He had been the chief's administrative right hand, but had never come up through the ranks. On the Chimera case, I was now reporting into him. No leaks, Trocchio brusquely warned. No contact with the press. All interviews go through me. A joint task force was set up to handle Mercer's homicide. It wasn't until I got upstairs that I found out precisely what joint meant. When I got back to my office, two tan-suited FBI agents were waiting in the outer room. A polished, preppy black man named Ruddy, in an Oxford shirt and yellow tie, who seemed to be in charge, and the typical hard-nosed field agent named Hull. The first thing out of Ruddy's mouth was how nice it was to be working with the inspector who had solved the bride and groom case. The second thing was a request for the Chimera files, all of them, Tasha, Davidson, whatever we had on Mercer. 10 seconds after they left, I was on the phone to my new boss. Guess I know what you meant by joint, I said. Crimes against public officials are a federal offense, Lieutenant. There's not much I can do, said Trocchio. Mercer said this was a city crime, Chief. He said city personnel ought to see it through. Trocchio sent my heart into a tailspin. I'm sorry, not anymore. Chapter 48. Later that afternoon, I drove out to Ingleside Heights to talk with Chief Mercer's wife. I felt I needed to do it myself. A line of cars was already stretched along the street around the chief's home. A relative answered the door and told me Mrs. Mercer was upstairs with family. I stood around, checking out faces I recognized gathered in the living room. After a few minutes, Eunice Mercer came down the stairs. She was accompanied by a pleasant-looking, middle-aged woman who turned out to be her sister. She recognized me and walked my way. "I'm so sorry. I can't believe it," I said, squeezing her hand first, then hugging her. "I know," she whispered. "I know you've just gone through this yourself. I promise you, I know how tough this is. But I need to ask you a few questions," I finally said to her. She nodded, and her sister floated back among the guests. Eunice Mercer took me into a private den. I asked her many of the same questions I had put forth to the relatives of the other victims. Had anyone recently threatened her husband? Calls to the house? Anyone suspicious lately watching the house? She shook her head no. Earl said that this was the only place where he actually felt like he lived in the city, not just ran the police force. I changed tack. You ever come across the name Art Davidson before this week? Eunice Mercer's face went blank. You think Earl was killed by the same man who did these other horrible things? I took her hand. I think these murders were all committed by the same man. She massaged her brow. Lindsay, nothing makes sense to me right now. Earl's murder, that book. Book? I asked. Yes. Earl always read car magazines. He had this dream when he retired.
This old GTO he kept at a cousin's garage. He always said he was going to tear it down and build it up from scratch. But that book he had stuffed in his jacket.
What book? I was squinting at her hard.
A young doctor at the hospital returned it to me, along with his wallet and keys. I never knew he had such an interest in that sort of thing, those old myths.
Suddenly, my pulse was racing. Can you show me what you're talking about?
Of course, Eunice Mercer said. It's over here.
She left the den, and in a minute came back. She handed me a paperback copy of a book every school kid reads, Mythology, by Edith Hamilton. It was an old dog-eared copy, looked as if it had been leafed through 1,000 times. I rifled through the pages and spotted nothing. I ran down the table of contents. Then I saw it. Halfway down, page 141, it was underlined. Bellerophon kills the chimera. Bellerophon. Billy Reffin. My heart clenched. It was the name he'd used on a 911 call about Art Davidson. He had called himself Billy Reffin. I flipped to page 141. It was there, with an illustration. The lion rearing, the goat's body, the serpent's tail. Chimera. The bastard was telling us he had killed Chief Mercer. A surge rippled through me. There was something else on the page. A sharp, edgy script, a few words scrawled above the illustration in ink.
More to come. Justice will be served.
Chapter 49. Leaving Mercer's home, I drove around in a sweat, terror-filled at what I knew to be the truth. All my instincts had been right. This was no random, racist murder spree. This was a cold, calculating killer. He was taunting us, the same way he had with the white van, with that cocky tape. Billy Reffin. Finally, I said, fuck it. I called the girls. I couldn't hold back any longer. They were three of the sharpest law enforcement minds in the city, and this bastard had told me there were going to be more killings. We set up a meeting at Susie's. I need your help, I said, panning their faces in our usual booth at the restaurant.
That's why we're here, Claire said. You call, we come running.
Finally, Cindy chuckled. She admits she's nothing without us. This Kiss by Faith Hill was drowning out a basketball game on the TV, but in the corner booth, the four of us were huddled in our own purposeful world. God, it was good to have everybody back together again. Everything's screwed up with Mercer gone. The FBI's come in. I don't even know who's in control. All I know is that the longer we wait, the more people are going to be killed. This time there have to be some rules, Jill said, tugging on a Buckler non-alcoholic beer. This isn't a game. The last case, I think I broke every rule I took an oath to uphold. Withholding evidence, using the DA's office for personal use. If anything had gotten out, I'd be doing my cases from the 10th floor. We laughed. The 10th floor of the hall was where the holding cells were located. Okay, I agreed. It was the same for me. Anything we find, we take to the task force.
Let's not go overboard, said Cindy with a mischievous laugh. We're here to help you, not to make the careers of some uptight bureaucratic men.
The Margarita Posse lives, joked Jill. Jesus, I'm glad we're back. Don't you ever doubt it, said Claire. I looked around at the girls, the Women's Murder Club. Part of me bristled with apprehension. Four people were dead, including the highest-ranking police officer in the city. The killer had proved he could strike anywhere he wanted to. Each murder has become more high-profile and daring, I said, filling them in on the latest, including the book stuffed in Mercer's jacket. He no longer needs the subterfuge of the racial M.O. It's racial, all right. I just don't know why.
Claire took us through the chief's autopsy, which she had finished up that afternoon. He was hit 3 times at close range with a .38 caliber gun. My impression is that the 3 shots were spaced at measured intervals. I could tell by the pattern that the wounds bled out. The last one was to the head. Mercer was already on the ground. It makes me think they may have confronted each other, that he was trying to kill him slowly, or that they were even talking. I guess where I'm headed is that it's likely Mercer knew his killer. You checked into the possibility that all these officers were somehow connected? Jill cut in. Of course you have. You're Lindsay Boxer. Of course I have. There's no record any of them had even met. Their careers don't seem to have crossed. Tasha Catching's uncle is younger than the others by 20 years. We can't find anything that puts them together. Somebody hates cops. Well, actually, a lot of people do, Cindy said. I just can't find the link, I said. This started out in the guise of a hate crime. The killer wanted us to view the murders in a certain way. He wanted us to find his clues. And he wanted us to find the chimera, his fucked-up symbol. But if this is a personal vendetta, Jill said, it doesn't make sense that it would lead back to some organized group. Unless he was setting someone up, I said. Or unless, Cindy said, chewing her lip, the chimera doesn't lead back to a hate group at all. Maybe this book is his way of telling us it's something else. I stared at her. We all did. We're waiting, Einstein. She blinked remotely, then shook her head. I was just thinking out loud. Jill said she would dig into any grievance cases against a black officer who had wronged or injured a white. Any act of vengeance that might explain the killer's mindset. Cindy would do the same at the Chronicle. It had been a long day, and I was exhausted. I had a task force meeting at 7:30 the next morning. I looked each of my friends in the eye. Thank you. Thank you. We're gonna solve this sucker with you, Jill said. We're going to get Chimera.
We've got to, Clara said. We need you to keep picking up the barbell.
For a few more minutes, we chatted about what we all had going on the next day, when we could get together again. We were starting to cook now. Jill and Claire had their cars parked in the lot. I asked Cindy, who lived in the Castro section near me, if she needed a ride. Actually, she said with a smile, I have a date.
Good for you! Who's your next victim? Claire exclaimed. When do we get to check him out?
If you supposedly mature, talented women want to ogle like a bunch of school kids, I guess now he's picking me up.
I'm always up for a good ogle, Claire said.
I snorted out a laugh. You could be meeting Mel Gibson and Russell Crowe, and it wouldn't rock my boat tonight. As we pushed through the front door, Cindy tugged my arm. Hold on to your oars, honey. We all saw him at once. We all ogled, and my boat was rocked. Waiting outside, looking altogether sexy and handsome, dressed entirely in black, was Aaron Winslow. Chapter 50. I couldn't believe it. I stood there gawking. I looked at Cindy, then back at Winslow, my surprise slowly giving way to a blushing smile. Lieutenant. Winslow nodded, cutting through the awkward murk. When Cindy said she was meeting friends, I wasn't expecting to find you here.
Yeah, me too, I babbled back.
We're headed to the Blue Door, Cindy said to the crowd, going through the introductions. Pinetop Perkins is in town.
Terrific, Claire nodded.
Beatific, snipped Jill. Anybody care to join? Aaron Winslow asked. If you haven't heard it, there's nothing like Memphis jazz.
I'm in the office at 6 tomorrow, said Claire. You two go along.
I leaned over to Cindy and whispered, You know, when we were talking foxholes the other day, I was only joking.
I know you were, Cindy said, looping her arm around mine, but I wasn't.
Claire, Jill, and I stood with our jaws opened and watched the two of them disappear around the corner. Actually, they looked kind of cute together, and it was only a date to hear some music.
Okay, Jill said. Tell me I wasn't dreaming.
You weren't dreaming, girl, Claire replied. I just hope that Cindy realizes what she's getting herself into.
Uh-uh,
I shook my head. I hope he does. Getting into my car, I entertained myself with the notion of Cindy and Aaron Winslow. It almost pushed out of my head the reason we had gotten together in the first place. I turned my Explorer onto Brannon and waved goodbye to Claire, who was heading over to 280. As I made the turn, I caught a glimpse of a white Toyota pulling out down the block behind me. My mind was wrapped up with what I had just done, getting the girls involved in this horrible case. I had just countermanded a direct order from the mayor and my commanding officer. This time there was no one backing me up, no Roth or Mercer. A Mazda with two teenage girls in it pulled up behind me. We had stopped at a light on 7th. The driver was talking a mile a minute on her cell phone, while her companion obliviously sung along to the stereo. As we started up, I kept my eye on them for a block until they veered onto 9th. A blue minivan took the Mazda's place. I got onto Potrero, under the underpass to 101, heading south. The blue van turned. To my surprise, I saw that same white Toyota lurking 30 yards behind. I continued on. A silver BMW sped up in the left lane and pulled up behind me. Behind it, a city bus. It looked as if the mystery car was gone. "Who could blame you for getting a little jumpy with what's going on?" I said to myself. My picture had been in the paper and on the TV news. I made my usual right on Connecticut and started the climb up the Potrero Hill. I was hoping Mrs. Taylor next door had come by to walk Martha, and I was thinking of stopping at the market on 20th for some vanilla twirl. Two blocks up, I glanced a last time in my rearview mirror. The white Toyota crept into view. Either the son of a bitch lived on the same block I did, or the bastard was following me. It had to be Chimera. Chapter 51. My heart was pounding. The hairs on the back of my neck stood erect. I squinted in the rearview mirror and ran the plate numbers over in my head. California, PCV 182. I couldn't make out the person driving. This was insane. But I sure wasn't imagining it. I pulled into an open parking spot in front of my apartment. I waited in the car until I saw the hood of the Toyota rise over the lip of 20th Street, then pause at the base of the last hill. My blood ran cold. I had let the bastard trail me right to my house. I reached in the glove compartment and took out my Glock. I checked the clip. Stay calm. You're going to take this asshole down. You're going to nail Chimera right now. I hunched in my car, scrolling through my options. I could call it in. A patrol car could be here in a matter of minutes. But I had to find out who it was. The appearance of a police car would scare him away. My heart beat madly. I palmed my gun and opened the car door. I slipped out into the night. Now what? On the first floor of my house, there was a back door that led to an alley underneath my terrace. From there, I could wrap around the block near the park at the top of the hill. If the bastard stayed outside, I could double back and maybe surprise him. I hesitated in the doorway, just long enough to see the Toyota creeping slowly up the street. My hands fumbled in my bag for the key. I jammed it into the lock. I was inside. Out a small window, I watched the Toyota. I strained to catch a glimpse of the driver, but his interior lights were off. I undid the bolt to the back door and crept out into the alley behind my building. I ran behind the cover of the houses to the cul-de-sac at the top of the hill. From there, I reversed back, hugging the shadows of the buildings along the opposite side of the street. Behind him. The Toyota had parked across from my building, its lights off. The driver in the front seat was smoking a cigarette. I crouched behind a parked Honda Accord, clasping my gun. This is what it's all about, Lindsay. Could I take Chimera in the car? What if the doors were locked? Suddenly, I saw the car door open.
The interior light flash on. The bastard's back was turned to me as he climbed out of the car. He was wearing a dark, weatherproof jacket, a floppy cap pulled over his eyes. He was glancing up at my house. My apartment. Then he headed across the street. No fears. Take him down. Now. The bastard had come for me. He'd threatened me in Mercer's book. I moved out from the cover of the line of parked cars. My heart was racing so fast and loud, I was afraid he would suddenly spin around. Now, do it. You've got him. I stepped up, the Glock firm in one hand. I wrapped the other around his neck, pulled, kicked his legs out from under him. He toppled to the ground, landing hard on his front. I pinned him there. I pressed the barrel of my gun to the back of his head. Police, asshole! Hands out wide! A painful groan came from him. He spread his arms. Was it Chimera? You wanted me, you bastard. Well, you got me. Now turn around. I relaxed my knee just enough for him to maneuver around. As he did, my heart almost stopped. I was staring into the face of my father.